Hello,
There you
welcome
go.
to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today, I think, has one of the most fascinating stories that I've heard to tell about his life in the mountains. I think the greatest stories in mountaineering adventure, they're about much more than mountains. They're about what our encounters with mountains tell us about ourselves. And 40 years ago to the day, my guest was involved in a life and death struggle to get down alive from one of the most formidable mountains on earth. And I think that he's lived to tell the tale is not only a tribute to him, but to the climbers on the mountain who, you know, selflessly put themselves at risk to save his life. So Simon O'Cartney's book, The Bond, not only tells about two incredible assaults in the wilderness of Alaska, but also talks about the bond between climbers who together pit themselves against the greatest challenges that nature can face us with. But I think it's better to let Simon tell his own story, really. Hello, Simon, how are you?
But John, thank you for having me. I'm alive and well in hot and sweaty Hong Kong at the moment.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear you're alive and well, if not hot and sweaty.
we've had a really good run with COVID-19 here. Like, you wouldn't believe it how good it's gone in Hong Kong compared with everywhere else. So lucky here at the moment. Really dodged the ball.
That's good to hear, because it's as you know in here in the UK, it's been a bit rough, really.
Oh mate, you wouldn't read about it, and I have so many friends in America as we become apparent. You know, I can't believe it's going.
Oh no, it's been pretty rough. But it was interesting to it was good to read your book. It sort of took me away from all this, really. I was going to ask you, how did you meet Jack Roberts, who was to become your partner for the great climbs that you did?
Well, I was having the time of my life in 1977 in the Alps, and I was climbing with Dave Wilker for that summer, a much more experienced climber than me, but we made a sort of interesting odd couple. You know, the young arrogant guy, me, you know, and Wilco, the sort of eccentric but very experienced mountaineer. And we had a ball. You know, we did 2 or 3 second ascents. We made a first ascent in the Bernese Oberland, but at the end of the season we climbed the central pillar of Bruya and climbed into a big storm, and we actually wound up rescuing 6 people from near the summit of Mont Blanc, but the weather was so bad that it snowed, you know, almost down into the village in the village, and there's nothing you can do when it does that but go to the pub, and that's where I did, and that's where I met Jack Roberts in the Bar National, and I was there on my own because Wilco had decided to go back to the UK because he had a job and I didn't, I was propping up the bar on my own, and this crowd of Americans came in, which is unusual. You know, you see people from all over the world in the Bar National. I reckon I could go there any day or any evening and probably meet 20 people I knew. But I met Jack Roberts and some other, you know, Tobin Sorensen and Rick Akamozo and Steve Shea and Mug Stumpf. You know, they were all on an American climbing tour of the Alps and doing great things. And I headed off with Jack, and he persuaded me that I probably shouldn't just go back to Chamonix the next summer, which was my inclination, is that we should go to Alaska. And we went climbing in Cheddar Gorge in the West Country of the UK, and we had a ball. Very similar sense of humour. We climbed some classics like Coronation Street and stuff like that. And, you know, one night in a pub, we had our own little Bar National somewhere in the Mendips, and we said, okay, let's do it, you know, and we decided to go to Alaska, and that's how it all started.
What was it drew you to Alaska there at that particular time?
Well, Jack spun me this story, which rapidly became obviously true, is that in the Alps, you know, everything's been climbed, I mean, even more now, but, you know, in 1977, 77, we thought the place was climbed out. But that's, you know, much more now than it was then. And he said, well, you know, you like first ascents, you know, let's go to Alaska because there are huge faces there. You know, most of the ridges have been climbed and nearly all of the summits have been climbed. But there's just vast acres of big faces that no one's even looked at and or looked at but not climbed. So that this was like a magnet to me. You know, this is really what I wanted to do. We lacked an objective. We knew we were going to go and we were going to do something exciting. And then thumbing through old mountain magazines, I found this picture on Mountain 40 of the north face of Huntington, which had been taken by the famous mountaineer and geographer, Brad Washburn. And there was this beautiful black and white picture of this. It was our Eiger. You know, I'd always wished I'd been born younger so that I could have been part of that, you know. But there was this incredible looking thing, clearly very dangerous, 5,700 feet high, you know, similar kind of proportions, a little bit more icy. And to add spice to it, Brad Washburn had added the comment that he thought that no one should ever climb it because it was too dangerous. And at the age of, you know, 21 and a half, that was like a magnet, you know, like playing chicken. And that became our objective.
But you flew in to the area, I think. What was it like when you first took a look at that face? Because it is, as you say, an incredibly dangerous route.
Well, if you haven't climbed in Alaska, you know, just getting to the glacier is awe-inspiring. You know, it's an overused phrase, but it is. You fly in a little plane with your mouth open. And particularly back in 78, because the planes were a lot littler than the ones they use now, generally speaking. And, you know, we took off from Tarkeetna and crossed the rivers and across the tundra and, you know, through narrow passes and in into an amphitheater called the Ruth Glacier. And you fly up it, and you're flying up it at an altitude of about 5,000 feet below the top of the top of the canyon, if you like. And we just landed at the bottom of it and got out with, you know, our, you know, half a dozen boxes and a couple of packs and a shovel. And the plane spins around and goes away, leaving you alone seemingly on the moon. So it's really very different from being in Chamonix or Chavinia or anywhere like where you can always see the village. You know, you don't feel remote. But when you go to Alaska, you really do. You know that you're only just below the Arctic Circle and you're all alone. And I like that. You know, it's commitment. And how did I feel when I looked at it? I thought, well, it's a bit bigger than I was thinking it would look like. And when you see it from underneath, it looks a bit worse than it looks like from Brad Washburn's photograph. But we'd come an awfully long way and we were determined to climb it.
So what was the climb itself like then?
We had two goes at it. And we discovered something unfortunate about Mount Huntington. It's just the wrong angle. So when it snows on it, it'll hold the snow just long enough for it to become a problem and then let go of it.
Right, okay.
And let go of it in streams. So you don't get huge... Well, you get two sorts of avalanches. It's got seracs all over it.
Yeah.
That can collapse at any moment, and you've got to run the gauntlet underneath those. But when it snows, it'll just, you know, you think, oh, we discovered it the first day, that it all goes to hell, you know, in about an hour. And we nearly got avalanched off it on our first attempt and had to hide under a rock. So the first part of the route, to answer your question, is a rock band of about, I don't know, 1,000 feet, something like that. It's quite difficult, you know. It's quite difficult mix climbing, particularly for that period. You know, you're rock climbing in crampons and having to use your tools to pull. Yeah, we were dry tooling a little bit. We were experimenting with it. It was hard, but then, you know, in a minute it just went belly up, and we had to hide under this overhang for the rest of the day, and wait, you know, for it to stop. Doing that, stop shedding, and then run away and go back and think about our plan. So our first attempt was interesting, as Jack said. You know, we had this. Jack wrote journals every day we were together and diligently did it. I was much too lazy. And he was much more honest with himself than he was with me, you know, and I only read these things 35 years later, you know, and he talks to himself saying, you know, this is really bad, you know, we could get killed here any minute, and, you know, we would never talk to each other like that, because who wants to open a can of worms of that time?
So as the climb progressed, how did it pan out? Because it really, as you say, the danger was phenomenal from reading your account of it.
We figured if we could get part, there's a band of Seracs above the rock band, and this is the real killer area. So we figured if we can get past those quick enough, the other objective dangers on the face wouldn't be so bad. So on our successful attempt, you know, we had a pretty good recce, and we figured out that where we attacked the rock band wasn't quite right. And the second time we did it, Charlie Porter was on the glacier, took a picture of us setting off, and we got past the rock band, you know, in the morning. I mean, we started climbing late at night because Alaska doesn't get dark. It's really convenient for alpine style climbing. And by the middle of the morning, we were past it, and we got past the Seracs, and we were on this little hanging glacier in the middle of the face. But we hadn't noticed that the weather had got dreary, you know, while we were doing that, and it started to snow again. And we had this terrible problem, you know, like within an hour, we were in a washing machine on this face, and the snow slurry, you know, running over my boots. I've got bow waves on my boots and my ice axes, you know, the Jack below me belaying is getting pelted in the face, you know, with waves of snow a foot deep. But luckily, before we got swept away, I found the Bergschrund at the top of this little hanging glacier, and we managed to get into that and hide. And it became a wonderful place, but a terrible place. It was perfectly safe in there. If being in a crevasse perversely can be safe, it was. But it was big enough to stand up inside it, and there was a big boulder that was sort of in there vaguely, and we could sit on that, and we could cook, and we could say. But at that point, we realized that we couldn't get down, so we were committed. The only way off was up, and the next 4 days were pretty torrid, because we set off on the next morning as soon as it stopped snowing, it stopped sliding, but we only made, maybe 400 or 500 feet of progress vertically, and the whole thing took off again, you know, and I was leading a pitch. I mean, in good conditions, it would have been an easy pitch to lead, and, you know, 60 degree ice up to a little boulder. And I managed to get under the boulder and belt in a couple of pitons and chop a little ledge. But while I was doing it, an avalanche kicked off above me, and it made a noise like wet concrete being poured from a great height. And it went straight over the top of my boulder and over me, and knocked Jack unconscious on the end of the rope. I could feel him, you know, wilt on the end of the rope as I was holding him on the belay, and he was out cold, you know, for 30 seconds, 45 seconds. It seemed like an age, you know. He got a real smack on the head from all that snow, and he came to, and when he did, he was extremely angry. You know, he was sort of almost mad at the mountain, you know, he was jabbing his ice axes into the ice with venom, you know, to get his own back, and some of the worst language I've ever heard in my life. And he came up and joined me, and we realized that, you know, the only way to survive, we had to dig in. You know, again, we had to get out of it. And we managed to dig in a little ice cave underneath this boulder that was possible to dig in. Couldn't go in very far, but we could go in and turn right and go horizontally about, you know, 7 meters. So that meant that two of us could lie down head to head in this little rabbit burrow. And pretend that we weren't scared, you know, making tea and not talking about the situation that we were in. Next day, we realized we had to get out of there. We'd only had 4 days' food, so we really attacked it the next, whenever it was. It was hard to remember whether it was morning or midnight. It doesn't make any difference in Alaska, you know, it's always sort of vaguely daylight. And we thought maybe we could get to the summit in one go. We got pulled up short really quickly on that optimistic idea. The climbing was much harder than we thought. And we'd chosen a line that would keep us in the middle of the face where it seemed logical. It was like a big ramp-like feature. And I was very given to giving names of things that had Iger connotations, so we called it the ramp. And we got into that and found that, you know, it was easy and then it would be really hard and easy to be really hard. We were like waves of vertical ice separated by a couple of easy pitches, and we couldn't avoid all of them. And anyway, we wound up bivouacking four times. And then on the last day, fifth day, finally topping out on the northeast ridge, which is very close to the summit where we were, and realizing we were on the summit of Denali, but Mount Huntington. But we were surprised because we'd expected, there were many other parties on the mountain. There was a team of Japanese. There were at least two teams of Americans on the east side. There were some friends of ours, we'd made friends with a team of four Americans, including Rom Lee and others, Eric Simonson. You know, went on to become a famous, you know, Everest, you know, guide. We thought for sure one of them would climb one of these other routes that surely must be easier than ours and been there before us. But the summit was completely virgin and there wasn't a sign of a footprint coming from any direction. We were the first that year and probably only the second because the Japanese didn't make it, but the Americans, Angus Thurman from the east side, did make it. Everybody else failed. We thought, I wonder what that means, you know. But at this point, I've got to confess that Jack and I were the most stupid climbers on the planet because we'd flown into Mount Huntington in a perfectly good aircraft. And we could, without any effort, have flown around the mountain a couple of times and had a good look at our descent route that we thought we could climb down, which was the French Ridge. And anybody who knows anything about the French Ridge these days would say that was the most ridiculous idea you possibly could. It's a nightmare. You know, it's made of overhanging snow mushrooms and huge double cornices, and we didn't have any of the pickets or, you know, belays that we'd need to get down. And we found ourselves in quite big trouble. Looking around, trying to find a way down, I actually fell back onto the north face because I fell through a cornice, which is really easy to do on Mount Huntington. Or in Alaska generally, and twisted my ankle, and I had to climb back up onto the summit ridge. And when Jack and I had a bit of a, you know, sit down conversation about what we were going to do to get out of there. So, with that in mind, Jack thought that he remembered that the west face of Mount Huntington had been climbed. I think called the Harvard Route. He knew. I mean, I hadn't read any of the books. I hadn't read, you know, Conquistadors of the Useless. I didn't know what Terre I'd find. I hadn't read Dave Roberts' book, Mountain of My Fear, and it was just all new. And we started to downclimb the west face, which rapidly turns into a very steep alpine route, but we started to find equipment, pitons and bits of tied off horrible polypropylene rope that you normally wouldn't touch, but we were, you know, we'd take anything we could find to anchor us. And we got to a famous spot, which is called the Nose Roof, where we stood on top of this obviously very big overhang. It's, you know, reminds me of the diving board in Yosemite Valley. I mean, you get to the top of this thing, it just falls away vertically underneath. And we rappelled off it. And I remember rappelling off it very carefully, you know, going over the lip and then, you know, going right to the end of the ropes and arriving on quite a nice snow slope. So, come on, Jack, gonna come down. And, you know, he rappelled very carefully, you know, the way you do when you separate the ropes so they don't twist around each other and you keep a finger between. Other people do this, but, you know, I was to keep part of my hand between the two ropes so that they would always be separated no matter what I did. So I got to the bottom, I knew that the red one was on that side or the purple one was on the other side. So when they pulled, they wouldn't, you know, get wrapped around each other. We got down and we pulled and something went wrong. We managed to move the rope and it moved about 80 feet and then it wouldn't move anymore. And that was all we got. We got 80 feet of rope. We're now a third of the way down the west face of Mount Huntington, all on our own, close to the Arctic Circle. We're out of food and we've got 80 feet of rope. And it took us 54 hours. We had a cup of tea, you know, and think about it. And we found that we could cut bits of this horrible polypropylene stuff. You wouldn't use it for a washing line, but we managed to get bits of it by cutting it out of the ice. So we had 80 foot of rope, and then in the end, after, you know, maybe 20 hours or something, we had another 80 foot of rope that was made up of 10 foot sections that were knotted together with fisherman's knots. So it was a thing that was very hard to abseil down, but you could do it in the traditional way, just wrap it around your body. You know, you couldn't feed it through anything because of all the knots. It took us 54 hours to get down. I know that because Jack timed it and put it in his diary. And we got down onto the Tokositna Glacier after, you know, like a 2-day push, and collapsed basically. I mean, the weather had cleared up. It was a sunny day. You know, we're in much better shape than we were. But of course, we're on the wrong glacier because we'd actually camped on the Roof Glacier, which is the other side of this substantial ridge. So we had to do I remember sleeping all day, so not going anywhere. And we had no food at all, but we had a little bit of gasoline to make water. So we were hydrated okay, you know. And that night, after I'd slept all day, Jack woke me up in the evening as the sun was setting. He said, "You all right, you know?" I said, "Yeah, man, I'm all right. Just, you know, a bit out of batteries." He said, "Man, I even checked your pulse. You didn't fall asleep. You know, you just passed out. I've never seen it like it." So we trudged across the glacier in the frosty night, and then climbed over this 1,500 foot ridge. And we got it just right. We managed to hit just the right spot, and we were down on the Ruth Glacier by lunchtime the next day, back at our campsite, the most windswept place. But I never felt such a fondness for a hole in the snow in all my life. You know, we realised we got away with it.
So it sounds like quite a formidable ordeal. I mean, battered by avalanche all the way, and most of the time under pretty severe threat from seracs above, for certainly the lower part of the mountain. So
I'm looking back as an old guy now. You know, I'm really glad that I did it. And then, you know, I was 22.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're an idiot when you're 22, right? You know, I was climbing really well. I'd had a bad accident in Cheddar Gorge in my teens, and that slowed me down a lot. I'd gotten over that, and I was going really well. And, you know, I just wasn't into, you know, we come all this way, we'll do it. And Jack was like catnip for me. You know, I've climbed with people that were better than me. I've climbed with people that, you know, but I'd never climbed with anybody who was so similar and so determined. And right. Jack was really good all-round climber. He was better rock climber. He was a Yosemite stone master. He was a fabulous rock climber.
Yeah, yeah. That route on Huntington, as far as I'm aware, that's never been repeated, has it?
No, it has been.
And it may never be.
It may never be, unless an idiotic 22-year-old rocks up at the bottom of it.
Someone as crazy as you. Exactly.
Well, I don't know. You know,
returned to do Denali, was it a couple of years later?
1980, Jack and I were sort of emboldened by Huntington, you know, because it was the first sort of super alpine thing. We were out for 10 days on, say, 5 days' food, if you're being generous, and, you know, we covered a lot of distance, big traverse in the mountain. It was, you know, we were pretty happy with what we'd done. And then, you know, we were in Tarkeetna. When you come down from the mountains in Alaska, it's not the same as the Alps, you know, like, I think I at one time I held the world record from the summit of Mont Blanc to the Bar National. You know, once the climb was over, you know, I wanted to be in the pub and you know, fish and chips and whatever. And you could, you know, you knew you'd be there within 12 hours or something. But Alaska's not like that. You get from your camp to Tarkeetna in 45 minutes. And it's just all too quick. You know, you've gone from being on the moon with nobody to being, you know, in this fabulous Western village. It's like being in a cowboy movie almost.
That's by aircraft, obviously. Yeah, they fly you off. Yeah,
by aircraft. I mean, so you get in by ski plane, you get out. And, you know, when we got back to the camp, I got on the radio, we heated up the batteries. And because the weather was good, lots of pilots were flying. And we got one of them, not Jim Sharp, our pilot. We got Doug Geating. And he went, "Okay, yeah, Doug here, you know, Sharp's been looking for you. I'll let him know." And, you know, within a minute he came back. Yeah, I got him, you know, because he had a higher elevation. And Jim was there in an hour, you know. So having done this amazing experience, or lived through this amazing experience, suddenly the taxi arrives and you get in and you leave. And then 45 minutes later, you're standing in a muddy field, you know, being bitten by mosquitoes. Nothing else is trying to kill you. You can have a hamburger if you want. You can do whatever you want. And it feels not comfortable. You know, it took us a day or so to get over it.
And so you were inspired by that route to attack Denali, which is a monstrous climb in itself, really, isn't it?
Well, it's the tallest mountain in the world, which confuses everybody. But it's just massive. You know, Tarkeetna has an altitude of 350 feet. And Denali has an altitude of 20,310 feet, and it's just 60 miles away. So it goes from being tundra to just boom, this huge thing. And you don't really understand the size of it till you get in a plane, start flying towards you, and it doesn't get any bigger in the window much, you know, as you're flying along at a high speed for a long time. And it's just awe-inspiring. Anyway, we'd seen it from Huntington. You know, you'd got a good view of the south buttress. We weren't thinking about it then, but when we got back to Tarkeetna, we hang around for a week because we really loved it there and the people are so great. And we went to the ranger station and it was this big Brad Washburn photograph, all taken on 6x6-inch plates. The detail was great, you know, of the south side of Denali. And there's only one ridge up it, which is the Cassine Ridge. But to the left and right are these huge faces. I mean, by say huge, I mean, they're 9, maybe 10,000 feet high. So you can drop, you know, 3 Yosemites or more into either one of those. The size is great. The first half is about 4,500 feet of steep and difficult rock climbing. And then another 4,500 or maybe a bit more of just an easy, apart from the altitude, you know, a fairly easy climb to the summit if you don't have anything wrong with you. And I said to Jack, you know, I said, is anybody... You know, I could see the Cassine Ridge, but has anybody climbed either side of that? And he looked at me with this, you know, wry grin and just said, well, not yet. And so I got my Eiger thing out of my system. I was just obsessed with the Eiger. My father's to blame. He bought me a book by Chris Bonington about climbing the Eiger. And I read that in my teens and I thought, okay, got to do this. So I would climb the Eiger with a bunch of friends in 1979, I eventually managed to get up it, not with Smiler Cuthbertson as I'd hoped, but a month or so later with Chris Hoyland. And that just was magic, you know, it was everything about that was just perfect. And then Jack Roberts rang me. I was working in Alpine Sports in London. I got this call, he said, you know, so some bloody American on the phone for you. And I thought, I only know one bloody American. So sure enough, it was Jack. And he said, what are you doing? The summer of 1980, as far as I know. I hadn't thought about it much. He said, well, how about we go and try that thing that we saw in the ranger station in 78? And I thought about it for all of about 30 seconds. I went, yeah, okay, let's have a go. And that became the most sort of fateful decision I've ever made, I think, to decide to go and do that. We borrowed the name of... another climbing expedition that we really liked was a climber from Alabama called Rob Newsom. And, you know, his accent was just so hysterical. He called his expedition to Mount Huntington in 78 the Too Loose Expedition. And that would just typify me and Jack. So we decided to be called the Too Loose Expedition because everybody who goes to Denali gives their expedition a funny name. And we trained like hell. You know, we were probably the fittest we've ever been in our lives. Jack had a couple of personal tragedies. Leading up to going to Alaska, two of his friends got killed in car accidents, separate incidents, you know. But we were in great shape and we were a little bit older and a little bit smarter. Jack was 28, I was 24 and a half, you know, something like that. Sense of humour had never really changed. We flew in with Doug Geating, who was not only a famous glacier pilot but a famous bluegrass musician. And we landed at Kehltna International Airport, which is the southeast fork of the glacier, which is at that time was overseen by a lovely lady called Frances Randall, who herself then in her 50s had climbed Denali as a girl or a young woman and was a concert violinist with the Fairbanks Philharmonic Orchestra, but would take on this job, which has been passed down over the decades to many other female mountaineers, most recently Lisa Roderick, who's the wife of a great friend of mine, Paul Westman. And, you know, and you used to ride, but it was different because when you fly in there, you're not on the moon. You know, you're on the moon with lots of other people there. It's a big expedition place, and there might be 50 or 60 people in there. It's noisy, and people bring in beer and play tape music. It's a little bit out of control. I didn't really like it very much, to be honest. I couldn't wait to leave. And the weather was set fair almost at once, and Jack and I pushed off for our objective, which was the southwest face of Denali, just to the left-hand side of the Cassine Ridge. And on the same day, two guys flew in, one called Mike Helms and one called Bob Candico. And they made friends in an unusual way. They tried to climb something else, and their climbing partners had left and just left them together, and they decided to get together and climb the Cassine Ridge. And we met them on our approach. Which is up the northeast fork of the Kelpner, which they call the Valley of Death, with very good reasons. It is just the most horrible glacier to ever be on. Lots of people have disappeared on it, nearly including us. The first or second night we camped together, our campsite was nearly swallowed by an avalanche. The blocks of ice were as big as cars, and they came as close to lean on my tent.
Right.
I was in the tent at the time, and I remember looking at Mike's face and watching the blood drain from his face and watching him turn tail with no shoes on, running in bare feet as fast as he could, you know, away from my tent. What was going on? But we all survived. And, you know, you get close to people when things like that happen. And the next day or so, we made igloos together because it was so windy at about 11,000 feet. And it turned out Mike Helms was a killer igloo maker. You know, he'd been carrying this carpenter's saw on the back of his pack. Like, I had a shovel, because in Alaska, everybody, you've got to carry a shovel. You know, you haven't got a shovel, you can't dig a snow hole. If it gets windy, you'll die. So you carry a shovel. But he had a carpenter's saw. I didn't know what it was for. But it's excellent for making blocks of ice to make igloos with. And we made three, one for him, one for Helms, one for Bob Candico, and a really big one for Jack and I that was so big that we could pitch the tent inside it and set out a windstorm. Until an early day in July when we set off. Bob and Mike climbed the Cassine Ridge, which is parallel to our route and arrives, you know, at the same summit, and our southwest face route, parallel their route to the left, and hopefully we would arrive at the same summit. So Jack confides in himself, in his diary, that he's really quite stressed by what we were about to attempt. And clearly I was too, because although I didn't write about it, Jack records my irrational behavior. You know, the night before, ants in my pants, can't sit still, packing and unpacking my rucksack 10 times to see if I can make it any lighter. And in the end, we set off early in the morning, 6 o'clock, off we went. We had 4,500 feet of technical ground, vertical gain to cover. And we decided that we would take 7 days' food, because we couldn't carry any more than that. Uh-huh. And it was all dehydrated stuff mostly. And a gallon of gasoline. And we had a tent this time. First day went all right. We climbed 1,800 feet. Couldn't pitch the tent. We had to chop out a ledge just to sit on it. But it wasn't windy that night. So with all our clothes on, you know, it was okay. And we sat there. And the next day we set off again. And I didn't get far because Jack was having problems with his feet. He didn't confess to me that he'd climbed a winter route in the Canadian Rockies with Tobin Sorensen the winter before and got frostbite and was beginning to have trouble with his feet.
All right.
So we had a short day and a depressing day because I got the first of the killer pitches in that. We thought that the angle wasn't going to be so bad, but every once in a while you get a pitch of 5'8 or 5'9, you know, which is absolutely totally fun in Yosemite on a sunny day in your shorts, but it isn't funny at all in double boots, you know, and maybe you're trying to carry your pack as well. And I nearly fell out of what became called the Fisher McCartney and would have killed us both if I had. And at the end of that, we were just so mentally exhausted, we bivouacked as soon as we could. The next day, we had a very short day. We climbed a few snow slopes, basically, and got to the middle of the face where we recognized this huge feature. In the middle of the southwest face of Denali is a boulder the size of a skyscraper. It must be 500, maybe 600 feet high, you know, might say 500. The singular rock. It's the biggest single bit of rock I've ever seen in my life. And we found as I approached it, underneath it was a perfectly flat snow ledge because it the thing bulged out. So what it formed was this flat platform underneath. So we had the best bivouac campsite ever. It was like being on Tranquility Base, you know, it was totally soothing. But apart from the fact that you had to get off it, you know, we actually spent 2 days there because Jack needed a rest and, you know, I wasn't feeling great. And this was the beginning of what felt to me like I had severe altitude sickness or something worse than, like, whenever I used to go to Chamonix, I used to climb Mont Blanc and try and get it all out of the way in one way, you know, trying to acclimatize in one painful, you know, vomit-inducing, you know, trip to the summit of Mont Blanc. And it felt like that, you know, you feel lethargic and sick and you don't want to eat. But if I sat still, you know, in that tent for a day, you know, I didn't feel too bad. But the next day, the symptoms started to become more obvious. And we had a tough day because we'd made a decision not to go the way that we thought that we would. We thought it was too difficult. We went another way. It was very difficult. You know, we had to traverse around. And toward the end of the day, I found myself blocked by an overhanging cliff with a splitter crack in it and saying to Jack, you know, I'm sorry, man, I don't think that I can climb that. You know, do you think that you can? And that was what became known to us anyway as the Roberts Traverse, another Eiger allegory. So he had to take all of his helmet off, his rucksack off, his shell clothing, crampons, and he led a pitch of, you know, solid 5'9" at about 15,800 feet, something like that, with not much gear on it. It was a traverse, makes it worse. It's one of the damnedest bits of rock climbing I've ever seen, really. You know, and we were using those great big heavy double boots, if you remember them, felt liners and leather, and they weighed about, I don't know, many kilos each. And he did it, and then it took me the rest of the afternoon to follow it because I had all of his stuff, and, you know, trying to press it diagonally was just desperate. So we got to our last bivouac in the rocks, which wasn't so bad. And the next day we confided in each other, like, we have to get out of the rocks. We can't waste any more time on this because we're using up all of our food. We've got to go. You know, we have maybe rations for 2 days if we're lucky. And the next day we did. I led a pitch and suddenly the rocks had all gone and we were on this big snowy face, which forms the middle part of Denali's upper tier. It's called the Clod Face, stands for Canadians Lost on Denali. It refers to an epic a few years before. And what should have been, you know, if we were going well, we would have dispensed with the rope and just followed, you know. But we were that tired and that stuffed and, you know, I was so dizzy that we pitched it all out, you know. And it took us another day to get to about 17.8. And by that time, my balance is beginning to go and I can tell that I'm really quite sick, but I don't know with what. You know, I had the agility of a cat, you know, as a young man, but I was having to lean on ice axes to keep my balance. You know, something's really odd. I mean, I could lead a pitch of snow, but, and then the following day, after we'd run out of food, foodless day one, we made it to the Cassine Ridge at about 19,000 feet. And then suddenly this wonderland opens up because your view of Alaska has been limited to one side of the Cassine Ridge because you can't see over it. And then you get there and suddenly the whole of Alaska is visible to you to the south and you can see Tucki, you can see Mount Huntington. I sat down to take some photographs. We both had Olympus OM-1 cameras and we were very keen to take as many pictures as we could. And then after finishing taking that, I said, Jack, I don't think I can stand up. And I couldn't. I could only get to my knees like a drunk. And then if I tried to stand up, I'd fall over. And, you know, Jack is deeply alarmed by this development. And, you know, in his journals, he's tearing himself apart. You know, what's wrong with Simon? And we only made it about another 400 feet before it became obvious that we would have to stop because I could only crawl and it was becoming cruel. So we camped and it was even cold. And we spent 2 or 3 days there. Jack tried to drag me over the summit. No further. You know, I retreated into myself and became like an imbecile and I found that I couldn't talk. I remember bits of it, you know, coming and going because what I had was cerebral edema where your brain swells up because the brain cells in your brain want more oxygen. It creates pressure between your cranium and the brain and if it increases, it'll strangle the cortex and you'll die. So Jack was faced with the most horrible dilemma, what to do. You know, does he stay with me and die with me with his feet, frostbitten feet, you know, getting worse every minute? Or does he try to do something proactive? But, I mean, what an awful thing to consider. You're leaving your best buddy on some faint hope that you might get lucky and find people that were well enough to help. Or, but most people, you know, don't get to the top of Denali, let alone get there and climb down the other side and risk. There were no helicopters available. But just before he had to make that decision, our two friends from the Northeast Fork turned up, Bob Candico and Mike Helms. And they'd been even slower than we had been. And they arrived in much better condition than we were in, certainly me, because they'd been eating it. And little council of war at you know, altitude in Alaska doesn't feel the same as it does it near the equator in the Himalayas. You know, there's less oxygen up there, I swear, close to the poles. Anyway, Bob Candico volunteered to stay with me in that place, you know, in the most remote position you'd ever be. And the other two would go on and alert the park service as soon as they could to our predicament, because none of us had radios, try and do something about it. You know, it saved my life. Bob tried to do the same thing, that after a day, you know, nothing happened, you know, and he tried to drag me over the summit and failed. I couldn't do it. Back to the tent. Perversely, if he'd managed to drag me over the summit, the extra bit of altitude probably would have finished me off anyway, because I was so close with the cerebral edema, not being alive anyway.
Yeah.
And he managed to get, I was hypothermic, but he managed to solve that by sleeping close to me and giving me hot water and things like that. So slowly starting to feel, you know, slightly less of an idiot. And we made the decision to go down. What he'd do is he'd tie the end of the rope. We had one rope, 150-foot rope, and he'd tie the end of it to me, and I would slide down the snow slope, because that part of the Cassine's not rocky, it's quite easy, on my bum, you know, and I'd slide down to the end of the rope and put my ice axe in the snow, and he would climb down and join me, and we'd do it again, and do it again, and do it again. And we got down to about 18,000-something and got overflown by Doug Geating in his Cessna 185. With one of the park ranger climbing rangers on board, Roger Robinson, who saw us. And we waved at them, which was foolish. Never wave at people. It makes you look like you're okay. And they reported to the park service that Candico and McCartney were descending the Cassine Ridge and it seemed to be all right. But the reality is we'd now been 4 days without food, and it got to be 10. And Bob got me down to a point where my head cleared a bit more and I could contribute, tie knots, you know, rig anchors. I was a very good technical climber. I was very weak. And he had some medicine for me, and it wasn't until long afterwards I found out what it was, because he was giving, so take two of these pills that'll help you in the morning. And I thought, well, maybe they're glucose or something. And in Washington State, we were doing a talk in Seattle together a few years ago, and the subject of drugs came up. I said, you know what, I've never taken a recreational drug in my life. And Bob cocked an eyebrow at me and said, you know, that's not quite true, son. You know, remember the stuff I was giving on the Cassine Ridge? I said, yeah, what was it? He said, it was speed, you did. I'll give you two and I'd take one. And we'd be good enough for 5 hours, but we had to make sure we were in the tent after 5 hours, otherwise we'd die. You know, it was just completely debilitated. We tried making tea out of toothpaste. Don't do it. Okay. And right at the end of our tether, we were descending through what's known as the second rock band, and we didn't have enough pitons. We had found some fuel on the way down, and we've since found the owners of the fuel, and they're all great friends. There was another party in 79 who dumped some fuel. We found that, so we had fuel, which we wouldn't have, and we found a coil of rope, which was good because we lost our rope and we needed that one. And then on an abseil where I was so confused, you know, I thought that I would abseil off the end of the rope. I tied a knot in it. Bob's looking down at me from above. He says, look, 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 you know, climbers, you know, and I'm looking at my what? And I turned around. It was the most convincing illusion. You know, sure enough, there's a Willans box tent and four guys staring up at me. And it turned out to be an expedition called the Freaks. And they took us in and they shared what little food they had left. Mike Pantelick was one of those, and Mike's a very close friend these days. And we descended back down. We wrecked their expedition completely. I mean, we bombed it. And over the next several days, we got down to about 14,000 feet, where we met with some Japanese climbers that Bob caught up with, and he used their radio to tell the Park Service that we weren't dead, because his greatest concern was that his parents would be informed that we were missing and presumed lost. And while he was doing that, he ordered some food. The Park Service said, "Do you want to be evacuated by helicopter?" And we said, "No, just bring us food." So it flew over and food bombed us, and we sat there for a day and ate it and started to repair a little bit of the damage that we'd done to ourselves. And from there, it all seemed to go so smoothly. Bob and I left our friends from the Freaks behind. We found that the Japanese had their fixed ropes from that point all the way to the bottom of the Cassine Ridge. And you get down really quick on fixed ropes. And we were camped, you know, that night. And all we had to do, we thought, nothing can go wrong now. You know, we run out of food again, but it's just maximum 2 days to get back to the landing strip. And we are home free. That's all we've got to do. But it didn't turn out that way. The next day, skiing out in a whiteout, Bob tripped in the ice fall and pulled me off my feet. And I cartwheeled through the snow past him and into a crevasse and fell about 120 feet into a crevasse, bouncing off the sides of it. And woke up upside down, staring into this blue hole, thinking, I don't know who I am, but I know I'm in a crevasse. And whoever else is on the other end of that rope is going to join me in here in a minute, unless something miraculous happens. And it did. There'd been some climbers nearby that had heard it. They were the people from Pennsylvania. And Steve Friddle, who I've since met, was the first to get to the edge of the crevasse and climb down into it, sort of half rappelling and half front pointing, and take the weight off the rope and getting a pulley on, you know, and getting the other three guys to pull so they could pull me out. That's how they got me out. You know, broken arm, broken collarbone, severe concussion, you know, starvation, cerebral edema. I should have answered to the name of Lucky. That was the last step I took on my own two feet. They couldn't fly me out. So a couple of days later, Dave Buchanan organized a posse of volunteers to ski up to where I was and drag me back to base camp overnight, where they put me in a tent all by myself because I smelt worse than anything that anybody could imagine.
Okay, well, you were rescued after an absolute epic getting down from Denali. Where did you find yourself then?
Well, they put me in a spare tent and gave me a beer and some chocolate. And I drank the beer, but I can't remember what I did with the chocolate. And I woke up in the morning with this brown goo in my hand. And it took me a little while until I realized that it was chocolate. And I was really happy and relieved about it. but I got flown out that morning. The weather turned fair. And Doug Geeding was the first pilot in and took me out and another victim of frostbite. Jack and Mike had already been flown out. And I didn't know whether either of them were. And we took off, and they flew not to Tarkeetna, but all the way to Anchorage, where we landed in a small strip and was an ambulance waiting, and took the two of us to Providence Hospital in Anchorage, which has a burns unit in it, which is ideal for treating frostbite, apparently.
Right, right.
And that's where I met Jack again. I didn't know really what had happened to him. I knew that he was alive. I didn't know where and how. I think he knew that I was alive, but didn't, same problem. Long story short, you know, after being admitted to hospital and they cut my stinking clothes off me and cleaned me up and x-rayed me and looked at broken bones, and they were particularly interested in my head because of the trauma of falling into a crevasse. And
yeah.
We wound up in the same ward together. There was a little ward of four beds, but there was just me and Jack. And I was wheeled in backwards, and then, you know, I turned around, and the nurse said, "You know, I believe you know each other." And, you know, that was the last bivouac of the two loose climbing expedition. not such a happy thing, you know. Jack was deeply troubled and I think traumatized by what had happened, you know, far more than me. I mean, you know, it's okay not dying, but it's really not okay to have to make decisions about somebody who might die. And I think it really, really affected him for the rest of his life. And, you know, much as
I mean, both of you went through what was one hell of an ordeal. I mean, technically speaking, you should have died. That's correct.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were visited by numerous surgeons, including a high altitude specialist who interviewed us the next day. And, of course, at that point, I had no idea what cerebral edema was. You know, it's fashionable now, but it wasn't then.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy interviewed me and said, well, you had cerebral edema, clearly. And I'm amazed that you survived, because everybody that I've ever heard of that contracts cerebral edema and continues to ascend, and clearly you had it for a couple of days, always dies. So, you know, I think that maybe Jack felt a bit better about that because he understood what had happened, but the fun was really over. And I spent a long, much more time in hospital than Jack did, because he'd already been there for, well, maybe we spent the same time, but he'd been there for a week or so before me.
Okay, okay. I mean, to fast forward a bit, you kind of stopped climbing after that. You turned your back on climbing for many years, really. And you know, is that because am I right in thinking that because for you it was immensely important to be climbing, if you like, at the cutting edge, at the extreme edge of climbing, where life and survival, and you were putting up new routes. And that the idea, I get the impression from the book, the idea that you would you would step back and do more comfortable routes just didn't appeal to you. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I had time to think about it because I was quite badly injured, so I couldn't go climbing anyway. So I had ample time to think about it. And I actually found out why I went climbing at that time. You know, people go into the mountains for all sorts of reasons, and I go into the mountains for very different reasons these days. But at that age, you know, Simon went climbing to do new routes on big mountains. And I came to the conclusion that if Jack and I continued in the vein that we were, we would become statistics. And the losses amongst my friends and acquaintances over the next few years bore out that theory, let's say. And I saw Jack alive for the last time in 1981. He was in London with Jim Bridwell, the famous Yosemite climber. They'd been to the Alps, and he looked me up. And Jack wound up staying with me for a few months in London. I'd just got married, and I think he was hoping maybe that we would go climbing again. But you know, I told him I'm just not going to do it. You know, there's so many rungs on the ladder, and I'm standing on the top one. There aren't any more. I can't see how this is going to end.
Yeah.
And we parted company, and it was sad, and we lost track of each other because there was no internet then. You know, and he moved to Colorado, and I moved to Australia. You know. And for the next 32 and a half years, I just assumed that he'd been killed. You know, because I thought I would have heard something, and he thought the same. But it wasn't the case. I was in Hong Kong, and a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, sent me a link. And Alan's a bit of a surfer. I'm not a keen web surfer, or wasn't. He said, look, some people looking for you. You should check out this website. And I did. And it was Super Topo, you know, that American climbing blog site.
Yeah.
And, of course, climbing had changed out of all proportion in 32 years, because I completely shut it out. Yeah. I didn't want to know about, you know, having a bad love affair. You know, the best thing you can do is forget her. If that's not such a crude illusion, or forget him. And I hadn't read Touching the Void. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know that Lycra had invented. I didn't know that sport climbing had invented. I thought bolts were a thing of the past. And, you know, I knew nothing. And I found this amazing website, and there was somebody looking for me. So he said, does anybody know where Simon McCartney is? Jack Roberts last saw him alive in 1981. And, oh, my God, you know, Jack is alive. After all these years, I never would have. And it just, you know, it's like an avalanche of emotion this time. You know, it was the middle of the night. And I thought what I would do, and I stayed up all night. And then I went back to the site and started doing a bit more digging. And after about 2 hours, I found that Jack had in fact been killed. I'd missed him by 2 weeks. There was a rest in peace message. And he'd been killed in an ice climbing accident on Bridalwell Falls in Colorado.
Yeah.
So I found him and I lost him.
Pretty devastating news, really, you know? Yeah.
I'm not over it, but I resolved that I would reconnect with everybody, and I have. And
right.
I thought that I'd better write about it. And
right.
I have.
You've written very well about it. I mean, I think you can take some satisfaction from the fact that you did two incredible climbs. You climbed right at the forefront of, as you said, the top rung of mountaineering. But not only that, by creating the bond, or by writing the bond, I think you've created, I suppose you've set those climbs down on what you and Jack did in those times. You've set those down for posterity, really, because I think, how do you feel about that? Does that give you some satisfaction?
Well, I've set the story straight for Jack, which was very important.
Yeah.
And for Jack's wife, Pam, you know, because there was some controversy over those climbs because of the circumstances in which they were conducted. I set the record straight, but I'm glad I wrote it when I was 60 and not when I was 25.
Yes.
Bob Candico rightly pointed out, if you'd written that book when you were 25, it would have been shit. but with all of the, you know, sort of retrospect that you have, the name is how I feel about, you know, this whole episode. It's this incredible link between climbers. And, you know, I'm so connected to all of the other people that were involved in this.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that struck me really about the book was, you know, the climbs were incredible, but the human story behind that, the human story behind other climbers absolutely selfishly willing to put themselves, their own lives at risk and their own ambitions to save anybody who was to save fellow climbers. And they did that. And I'm sure that's something that you would have done without a moment's thought as well.
Well, whatever, you know, I never was in that position, but Bob Candico is very close to me. And we were supposed to be in Alaska, all of us, Pam and Bob and Mike, and we were going to go and fly over Denali and maybe, you know, camp on the glacier for a night or something. We're as close as can be, and I think you only get that close by having these kind of intense. I think my father had the same feeling, you know, when I was a kid. He came home late from the war. He was a British officer with the Gurkha regiment.
Oh, right. Okay.
Fighting in Burma. And I don't think you can have a worse time than that. Every year, you know, he would talk about his connection with his Gurkhas, and he'd go to these regimental things, you know, and I'd see my old man come back rusty with tears.
I think adversity brings people together more than anything else, really. But listen, that's been fascinating, and I think an incredible achievement, and I think the book itself will stand. I think it's certainly one of the best mountaineering books I've read. And it's already won multiple awards, and I think it'll stand the test of time for a long time. So, you know, thanks for sharing that with us. It's been incredible talking to you, and I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, John, look, just thank you for your hospitality. You know, people's kindness and interest in that book continues to amaze me. I still pinch myself at the response.
Well, I think the response is well deserved. Been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. All the best, and I hope your book goes well in the future. Thanks very much, Sam McCartney. Thank you.
You're welcome, mate. I hope we get to meet face to face when we don't have COVID-19 anymore. That's got to be the most.
Yeah, in that sunny place we'll hope to get to. That's great. Thanks very much, Simon. Bye bye.